Over the years, one of the changes that has occurred in the delivery of actual chemotherapy that's given direct into the vein is that the number of staff who administer these drugs have been reduced, and extensive training programs have been put in place. And the main reason for this is that 20 to 30 years ago, if a drug accidentally leaked into the surrounding tissues, so leaked outside of the veins into the surrounding tissues, it could cause a lot of damage. The rare patient may have needed plastic surgery or even an amputation. By reducing the number of staff who deliver these drugs, and actually by putting in these training programs, we've reduced the number of events that happen, and they're managed quicker if they do occur, and the long-term damage that can result is considerably less. So, as a consequence, what you find with that now is that it's mainly the nurses who deliver all of the intravenous chemotherapy. And even within nursing, it's only a small group of nurses who've been specially trained to do it. And therefore, it provides safer delivery of chemotherapy to patients. So, once it's been agreed between the doctor and the patient that they are to go ahead with treatment, they would be referred to the day treatment unit or to the ward. It depends on the type of treatment. There is a very small number of treatments that are still given as an inpatient. About 98% of our treatments are the day treatment unit. So we receive a referral, and then we'll contact the patient and make a decision with the patient as to a good time to start. For some treatments, it may be on certain days, and for other treatments, there may be greater flexibility. But it's just making sure that not only does the starting of the treatment fit in with the day-to-day running of the day treatment unit, but it also fits in with the patient's home circumstances. When a patient attends for their first cycle or first episode of chemotherapy, they will be assessed, and the doctor will have gone through the side effects of treatment and how to prevent and best manage them. The nurse will reiterate that advice that was given, and we'll also elaborate more on what to expect during the day and how long the treatment's going to take, clarify any questions that the patients may have, and also the duration of treatment. So, depending on the cancer, depending on the treatment, it can be as short as 15 minutes, it can be as long as 8 or 10 hours, and then it'll be the number of cycles. So, a cycle is an episode of chemotherapy. And that each of those episodes would be given every 1, every 2, every 3 weeks, depends on the regimen. And then the number of episodes would be dependent on the regimen. Some can be 4, some can be 6, some can be 12. For example, a cycle, and if I look at the most common regimen of chemotherapy for breast cancer, is called FEC. That's a little acronym we have. That's based on the three drugs that we administer for that particular type of cancer. So F is 5-fluorouracil, E is epirubicin, and C is cyclophosphamide. So we take the first initial, put it together, and they've given an Irish person a regimen called FEC. We would then look at how often we're going to give this FEC. So currently, the regimen says it's administered every 21 days, and we would then give maybe 6 cycles. In recent years, since docetaxel came out, we tend to give 3 cycles of FEC. So that's every 21 days, we give a cycle of FEC. And then after 3 lots of FEC, we then swap the patient to 3 cycles of docetaxel, which is also given every 21 days. If a breast cancer is diagnosed and it's quite a large tumour and can be more than 3 centimetres, we may decide to do chemotherapy first before surgery. And the idea is to downsize that tumour, to shrink it down. And what we've noticed since we've started using FEC and docetaxel is that the combination of the two different regimens shrinks the tumour so much that it completely disappears on scan, and therefore we've had to start inserting markers in the area where the tumour is, so that at the point when the surgeon comes to do the surgery, they can take away tissue and they know where the tumour was originally. Patients will come in and have their chemotherapy today, and next time they're due in 21 days, we will try to keep the same nurse for that patient, but that's not always possible because of annual leave, or that nurse could be treating another patient at the appointment time. It's a constant balancing act of trying to fit appointments that suit the patients and fit in with the day treatment unit. So where we do try, a lot of the time it's not possible, but invariably you have the same small group of nurses working each of the days. So you might have some nurses working part-time and they work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and another group work Thursday, Friday. So the patients do get to know that group of nurses when they come in, that the faces start to look familiar. For chemotherapy to be administered into the vein, there's various ways we can do it. One is where we insert a needle direct into a vein in the forearm. The advantage with that is that it's done quickly, but actually it can only stay in place for a short period of time. There are other devices that we can use, and we call these central venous catheters. So I think of it as a long tube of spaghetti, and there are three types that we can use. So the first one we have is a PICC, which is peripherally inserted central catheter. That tends to be inserted midway between the elbow and the shoulder. That has to be inserted by a team of specialist nurses under local anaesthetic. And that catheter can be left in place for several months. The next type of catheter we have is called a tunneled catheter, and that's inserted on the chest wall, and that is more complicated. Patients need local anaesthetic and some mild sedation. That's more complicated, but that catheter can last for several years. And the same team of specialist nurses can insert the catheter, and when it needs to be removed, remove it as well. And then the third type of catheter we have is called a Portacat. Not seen so much here in the UK, is beginning to grow in popularity, but at the moment requires a surgeon to insert it, and the patient needs to have a general anaesthetic for it to be inserted, and likewise for its removal. However, there are processes developing, and there are some places that are able to do it under local anaesthetic. Which one we go for depends on the type of cancer, where it is, and the type of chemotherapy patients are having. If a chemotherapy is thought to be very toxic to the vein, we may look at inserting any one of those catheters rather than a needle into the arm. But there are some regimens, because they need to be given over a long period of time, or if patients have small, fragile veins that it's not easy to stick a needle into, we would then look at using one of these catheters. And it just depends on what the cancer is, what treatment we're giving, the duration as to which one we would give. So if we look at FEC and docetaxel, we know epirubicin is very toxic to the inside of the veins and can cause a problem called phlebitis, which is an inflammation of the veins, and that can be very painful and leave patients with an ache or a pain for several months after they finish treatment. And it can also cause hardening of the vein that can reduce mobility of the arm, so they have problems opening and closing, stretching out and closing up their arm at the elbow, and we call that cording. So to prevent that, we now, for all patients receiving FEC, like to insert a PICC line so that we maintain the integrity of those veins. So should they need them for any other occasion, they have them. But also it prevents the pain and the ache and the reduced mobility. Tunneled line we would use in certain types of breast cancer, but that's rare and infrequent. Portacat we may use in patients who are undergoing long-term treatment. So an example would be if somebody has got metastatic breast cancer, so it's spread to their somewhere else in their body, but they're eligible for Herceptin. So on their cancer cell, there is a protein called HER2, and this group of patients are known to be really sensitive and respond well to the drug called Herceptin, which is a new drug. Well, it's not new in that it's only come out in the last 2 years. It's been out for the last 15 years. But on the grand scheme of chemotherapy, is a new drug. And patients respond really well to Herceptin, but they stay on that treatment. They come in and out every 3 weeks for a cycle, and they stay on it until disease progression. So they're a good group of patients to look at inserting a portocath, because it's under the skin surface and they can maintain activities normal to home life. If they like swimming, the rate of infection, because it's under the skin, is considerably reduced. And those lines are made to last for many, many years and can be used indefinitely. With catheters, the central venous catheters, what we like is going back to the long tube, thin tube of spaghetti. No matter where it's inserted, we want that tube to meander up through the veins and end up in the lower third of the superior vena cava. So my analogy is, think of the veins in our hand are like single track roads. And as we go up the forearm, think of us like driving, and now we've got onto a B road. And on the B road is where we would insert the needle, or its other name is a cannula, for giving the short infusions of chemotherapy. By the time we get up to between the elbow and the shoulder, we're looking at bigger veins, so think of them as the A roads. And as we cross over and go towards the heart, we're heading onto the dual carriageway, onto the motorway. So where the tip of the catheter ends up is the lower third superior vena cava, and that's like being on the M25 going round London. And the whole aim of getting the chemotherapy entering the blood supply at that point is there's a bigger volume of blood, there's greater pressure of blood, the heart pumps the blood around the system much quicker, and it prevents the buildup of drugs in that local area that can irritate the inside of the vein. And when I talk about irritation of the vein, think of it irritating the inside of a vein like sunburn does to your skin, and some chemotherapy drugs can cause that type of irritation. Paclitaxel has been around for a long time. When it first started getting used, I had just joined working here in this hospital, and it was in some of the late phase research trials we were doing. So I've been administering that on and off for the last 22 years. Docetaxel is a newer drug, but I likewise have been administering that for the last 12 years, both as a standard treatment for breast cancer, but also as a trial treatment, depending on what research trials we have going on. Paclitaxel is more complicated to administer. There's a greater risk of patients having an allergic reaction to it, so they need to have quite a big pre-medication, where we have to give drugs to prevent this allergic reaction. And we give those three drugs intravenously before we start the paclitaxel infusion, and then we have to wait half an hour to make sure they've taken effect. Docetaxel is also given every 3 weeks. We don't have to do the pre-medication intravenously beforehand, but the patient does need to start a steroid drug the day before, and then have it the day of treatment and the day after. And that's to prevent some side effects of treatment. They have a similar side effect profile on one level, but on another level, they have quite a different side effect profile. Peripheral neuropathy will be quite a significant side effect. So that's where patients get pins and needles in their fingers, their toes, their feet. And we have to closely monitor that. And if it begins to affect quality of life or activities of daily living, walking, dressing themselves, doing closing buttons, opening buttons. Think about people's lifestyles. If they play the guitar or they play an instrument, we have to take those into consideration when deciding to treat with paclitaxel, or also monitoring the patient during the infusion and certainly in between cycles of treatment, making sure that if the side effect has happened, that the patient has recovered. Sometimes we may have to extend the 21-day cycle to allow patients to recover before we go on with the next cycle of chemotherapy. Nausea and vomiting, I think the side effect with both drugs is the risk of infection. So we will give patients quite prescriptive advice about how to watch out for signs and symptoms of an infection and what to do should it happen and who to contact. Nausea and vomiting, not so much with docetaxel, it can be mild, but it's also warning the patient and making sure they've got appropriate medication at home. With paclitaxel, hair loss is complete, so it is not just your scalp hair, but it can be eyebrows, eyelashes, hair on your body. Whereas with docetaxel, it tends to be just the hair on your scalp and maybe on your legs. The rest of your hair may thin, but doesn't seem to lose it all completely. With docetaxel, we are able to offer patients scalp cooling, which is to try and prevent hair loss. And it's where we apply a cold cap on for a set amount of time before treatment, during the treatment time, and again, it stays on for a certain period of time after we finish the chemotherapy or the docetaxel. And the aim is that by applying this very cold cap on, it reduces the blood supply to the scalp, to the hair follicles, and then it prevents hair loss. And for some patients, this works very well. For others, not so well. But for those where it works well, it's really worth trying. And so we offer it to all patients on docetaxel. For patients who are receiving paclitaxel, we don't offer it, only because they'd have to spend something like 6 hours with the cap on, and that would be intolerable. But we then offer both groups of patients other advice about wigs, use of scarves, and where to get more information. With chemotherapy, the list of side effects may look the same from one regimen to another. And if you look at the Macmillan website and the chemotherapy information leaflets, the side effects can start to all look the same. The skill and the challenge for a nurse looking after the patients receiving chemotherapy, and through reading the evidence from research, but also in asking patients and hearing their stories, you actually begin to pick up the incidence of side effects and the severity and how patients coped and how they best managed. And that's where you can then add that information to other patients. So if I look at the risk of infection is greater with a patient receiving docetaxel than it is with a patient who's receiving paclitaxel. And that would be one example. The risk of nausea and vomiting is less in a patient receiving docetaxel, but more in a patient receiving Taxol. So it varies. And you learn that in part from listening to your patients, but also then from the research trials and evidence that's out there. My analogy for how chemotherapy kills cancer cells is that if you think of us as humans, we go through our life as a baby, toddler, child, teenager, young adult, middle-aged, elderly. And in the same way, a cancer cell goes through various stages of life before it dies. And so when we develop our cancer drugs, some drugs will work on a specific part of that life cycle. So it may hit the teenage phase, or it may be more for the adult phase. And by giving the chemotherapy every so often, every 21 days or over 6 cycles, what you're hoping is that as cells enter a certain phase and that the drugs, they're exposed to them, and then you kill the cancer cell. And then as you kill that cancer cell, the next cancer cell that's at an earlier stage by 3 weeks later, it's moved into that phase of the cell cycle. The chemotherapy kills it at that stage. That's just really a very simple explanation of how chemotherapy affects the cancer cells. There is lots of, could go into the specifics, but actually at that point I tend to Google it. I can give an overall view, but I tend to Google it if patients are asking that question and go through it individually with the patient. I don't get too hung up on the science of how it works on the cell cycle, only if the, and it's not that many patients ask us. Patients, how they cope with chemotherapy varies from individual to individual. I think in the first instance, it's how it's affected the patient physically. My analogy for chemotherapy is when our research trials pick out doses of chemotherapy, that's what works well for the average population. But actually, when it comes to giving treatment to people, we can have a good estimate of how it's going to affect them. But for some patients, so my story I liken it to is if I have three men of equal height and equal build standing, and I give them each six brandies to drink or six mugs of strong coffee to drink, actually how that affects each of them will be different. So one man will be nicely merry or feeling a bit, if it's coffee, he's got some palpitations, but not much, he can cope with it. And so he's tolerating it quite well. Another person will fall flat on their face, and another person will be just nicely merry, whatever, have some side effects, but generally coping with it as well. So chemotherapy can be like that. And what we aim for is the middle, where people can tolerate it and that we managing the side effects as best we can. But there, for some patients, the chemotherapy can completely floor the patient, flatten them. So they might have one side effect, they might have two, or just fatigue and just taking themselves to bed. Some of them can be emotional, feeling more tired. If they get a side effect, it can run into other complications that then need managing. So we need to be careful when we're telling patients about chemotherapy up front, what the potential side effects are and how to prevent or manage them. What's important to say is that not every patient will get every side effect, but some people, it can really knock them sideways. And then there's the emotional, there's the financial impact. You know, have they got to continue working? If they're off, do they get paid sick leave? Have they got an income coming in? Then if you're constantly feeling fatigued, what are the burdens of family life? Have you got a young family? Are you a single parent? Are you elderly? Are your family living far away? All of those issues. So then you can get all the other anxieties that can come through, and that can be displayed in tearfulness, not sleeping, not eating, anger, anything like that. So it's a wide, vast range of things that we see, both physical and on emotional level, and it's trying to pin them down and try and address each one as best you can. Fatigue post-chemotherapy is a side effect not to be underestimated. It can be a physical cause as well as an emotional cause. Physically, in that we give you toxic drugs, and all these toxic drugs are floating around your system. And if you think about, if you're hungover, you've got fatigue, chemotherapy can have the same effect. Likewise, in killing cancer cells, you've got more toxins floating around, and this can make the body feel sluggish and cause a degree of fatigue. Very much then another cause would be that chemotherapy not only kills cancer cells, it can also kill normal cells. And one of the ones it affects is our bone marrow that produces blood. And if that count is reduced, part of our blood is called red blood cells, which contains hemoglobin. And if that's low, we're anemic, and that can cause fatigue. So there's any number of reasons why fatigue, if nausea, vomiting is a problem, diarrhea, people start not drinking much, not eating much, that in turn can lead to fatigue, and gradually it can build up. So what patients will often say is that during a 3-week cycle, fatigue will kick in. So they may have it for 2-3 days post chemotherapy, then they recover, but as the blood count starts to drop, the fatigue can kick in again for the second week, and then as you get to the third week, they start to feel much better and they've got more energy, and that's as the drugs have been washed out of the system and they've recovered, their blood count has recovered. In relation to what advice I'd give to a friend if they were diagnosed with cancer, it depends on the type of cancer and what I think the chemotherapy regimen will be, especially in the world of breast cancer. Once it's suspected, and certainly in the NHS, it actually processes happen very quickly. And so sometimes I feel we're ahead of the processes as professionals, but patients are struggling to catch up. And it's trying to just reassure patients that that's okay. So it's offering that physical, pragmatic advice and then allowing some time for the comfort and being sad and saying, actually, it's okay. Go and have a good cry now. Let's go out and have a drink. You know, life's tough. Life's a bee. But actually, that's okay. Whereas I had another friend several years ago who got diagnosed with advanced breast cancer. And what was interesting about that, she was all upset. And I said to her, okay, one thing I could probably pretty much guarantee you is somebody else will die. If life has taught me one thing, is that somebody else that we know will die before you do. We were having this conversation. And sure enough, 6 months, 9 months later, she rang me to say that another friend of ours we had grown up with had dropped dead of a heart attack that morning. My friend, who's on her various treatments for her advanced cancer, is still alive. I think for me, the difficulty, or if I look back on that situation, is that actually I was 10 steps ahead of her, and I was always having to remind myself to think about where she was now. And as she moved forward, I think as she had, she and her family lived in this hope of a cure, but I always knew it was never going to be a cure. So I would have to go along with the cure. And then every so often you might not agree with her, but every so often you would just go along with that. And it was really only as she went, relapsed the first and the second time, you know, by the time she relapsed the first time, for her, the cure was no longer possible. But it was then turning it into living with cancer. And actually, we could live with cancer. And then she had to go through all the uncertainty of the ups and downs and the living with cancer. So now as she's gone through her third and her fourth relapse, she's much more philosophical. But what was interesting with there was the family were always a relapse behind. So she relapsed the first time, had more treatment, went into remission, but they were still thinking of a cure. And it's only as she relapsed the third time that they began to acknowledge and say, okay, cure is not. And I think that was more maybe for them not knowing how to deal with her and their need, as opposed to them maybe not inside, internally, believing, you know, knowing or acknowledging that, you know, she wasn't curable. But as I said, she's, you know, 7 years on and she's still tolerating whatever treatment they've got her on now. Where chemotherapy is going, there will always be a place for the intravenous drugs for the foreseeable future. But in recent years, we have a lot of new, what we call targeted therapies coming out. And this is where, when a tumour is diagnosed and the cells are looked under a microscope, they can see what the differences are between a cancer cell and a normal cell. What's different between, say, a breast cancer cell and a normal breast cancer cell. And then what the new drug's trying to do is targeted that cancer cell for that particular difference. And the aim is by creating a drug that kills the cancer cell with that particular difference, is that more people are cured or more people stay on treatment. So, for example, Herceptin, there's a particular protein that's found. About 25% of the breast cancer will have a huge proportion of HER2 proteins on the surface of their cancer cell. And the drug Herceptin, or it's otherwise known as trastuzumab, comes along and prevents the cell developing further. It latches onto this HER2 protein, prevents the cell from dividing, and then the cell dies a natural death. And that's why we have more patients who are diagnosed with spread of their breast cancer, who are HER2 positive, but are now living for several years because of this drug Herceptin. And also patients who are diagnosed and have Herceptin back at the curative stage, fewer patients are relapsing now compared to 15 years ago. So we have a wealth of new targeted drugs coming out and that are continuing to be developed. So one of the things we need to plan for the future is all of these new targeted drugs. They tend to be, where possible, in a tablet format, and that in itself brings a different side effect profile. But we also have to educate patients differently, because we have to educate them about taking these drugs at home. And for some patients, taking some of these drugs, a small group of patients might like to come into hospital and have their treatment, because that's keeping the cancer in the hospital. Whereas if you bring these drugs and have them at home, it's actually bringing the cancer into the home. So it's quite a complex issue. But oral treatments is, and these new targeted therapies, are the way of the future. With these new treatments, and the thing to remember is, with a lot of them, patients stay on them till disease progression. So patients are going to be living longer with cancer, and potentially there will come a time point when cancer and these treatments will be a long-term chronic illness, just like diabetes, asthma, those other conditions that are routinely treated in the home.